Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this November the 9th on the West Coast, now November the 10th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome all the listeners we have around the world listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network, and hope you enjoy tonight's show. Actually, the past two times tonight's guest was scheduled to be on the show, we had some communication problems, but resolved those, and it's a pleasure for me to have him back on the air. He was with us a few months ago, and hailing all the way from Argentina. I'm going to bring him on first by telling you a bit about him. Adrian Salbucci is an Argentine consultant, researcher, author, and public speaker specializing in New World Order power structures and their economic, financial, and monetary mechanisms. He's a member of CREAR, or C-R-E-A-R, Consejo Regional Estratégico Argentino, or Argentine Regional Strategic Council, and please forgive my pronunciation here, and CEEMFRA, or Centro de Estudios Económicos Mariano Fragueiro, or Mariano Fragueiro Economic Studies Center. He has authored several books and many essays on geopolitics and economics written in Spanish, notably El Cerebro del Mundo, La Cara Oculto de Globalización, for The World's Mastermind, The Hidden Face of Globalization, Argentina, Colonia Financiera, Argentina, a Financial Colony, and Bienvenidos a la Jungla, Dominio y Supervivencia en el Nuevo Orden Mundial, or Welcome to the Jungle, Domination and Survival in the New World Order. Adrian is host to several radio talk shows, notably El Traductor Radial and Bienvenidos a la Jungla, and has spoken in hundreds of conferences, panels, congresses, and seminars at universities, schools, NGOs, the Argentine Army and Air Force war schools, and political and economic centers throughout Latin America. He appears regularly on local television and radio programs. A series of his videos in English and Spanish on these subjects is available on YouTube. He is the founder of the Movimiento, let me restate that. Movimiento por la Segunda República Argentina, a political project to found a second Argentine Republic as a necessary initial step to overcome Argentina's present difficulties. Adrian lives with his wife in Buenos Aires and has four adult children. And in case you're interested, his website is www.asalbucci, I'll spell that for you, asalbucci.com.ar, where many of his English articles have been posted. And with that, I welcome back to Evident Footprints my good friend in Argentina, Mr. Adrian Salbucci. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Hello, Don. Great to be back on your show after our technical glitches, and I must congratulate you on your very good pronunciation in Spanish. You did that very well.
It's too late in the night.
No, but you did just fine.
Well, it's been a while. You know, I should practice that a little bit more, but you can teach me.
It came through wonderfully, don't worry.
Okay, so how are you, my friend?
Just fine, working very strong, working very hard, and trying to come to grips with everything that's happening in the world, basically, and also here in my country, in this corner of the world, which is Argentina, which has a different stance, a different viewpoint as to what is happening. So, very concerned about some of the things that are happening down here also. But basically, the interesting thing is that the problems of Argentina throughout recent times are really no different, although the scale may be different, than the problems that you are facing now in the U.S. or the Europeans are facing over in Europe.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, you came out with a press release. I don't want to jump the gun here, but October 19th, Argentina targeted by world government, danger over Patagonia. And as I read that, I saw the parallels to what's currently going on here in the United States. And this began at least some 10 years ago, it appears, if not longer.
Yeah, well, just for people to have an idea, if you close your eyes and you think of a Mercator projection of the map of the world and you draw the line smack in the middle, which is the equator, you will automatically see the first thing that'll strike you is that about two thirds or even more, three fourths of the landmass of the planet is north of the equator, while south of the equator you have relatively very little land. You have about half of South America, you have about a third of Africa, and then you have Africa, New Zealand, and that's about it, except for Antarctica, which is in a story altogether by itself. Argentina, which is way down in the southern tip of South America, the southern part of South America, I should say, has an area called Patagonia, which is a region. It's a region that includes both Argentina on the east and Chile on the west. In the case of Argentina, it is five provinces, and those five provinces are very underpopulated. They've been kept artificially underpopulated for many years, and there have been territorial appetites from the world, the global powers, for at least 120, 130 years, going way back to when the founders of the International Zionist Movement, notably Mr. Theodor Herzl, in his book, his seminal book, A Jewish State, which was published in 1896 and forms the very basics and the very starting point for modern Zionism, he says in that book, and the title of one of its chapters is very eloquent in itself, he says, Palestine or Argentine? Because there was and still is a long cherished project by the International Zionist Movement to found two states, one of which already exists naturally in Palestine, which is the State of Israel, and a second state in Argentina. And, I'm really very concerned about that, because you find Mr. Herzl saying things like Argentina is by nature one of the richest countries on earth, with an immense territory, scarce population, and a moderate climate, which means that the Argentine Republic would have the greatest interest to cede to us a part of its territory in compensation for a financial award or a financial prize. Now, this was said back, Don, way back in 1896. If we fast forward to the present day, when in 2002 we were in the midst of one of our worst financial and banking and social collapses, the New York Times published an article in 27th of August 2002, where again the title is very eloquent and it says it all. The title of that article in 2002 in the New York Times was, "Some in Argentina See Secession as the Sole Solution to the Problem of Paying Its Foreign Debt." So you figure, wow, you know, like over 100 years perspective, and you see how a long-term plan is being slowly brought about.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, what's amazing is how much of this coincides with what transpired at the turn of the 20th century in the United States as well. This all seems to be orchestrated or have been orchestrated in a multidimensional way internationally, and the parallels and the connections to World War II and post World War II are just off the charts. I'm sure you've seen those parallels that I'm speaking about. For instance, the escapement of the Nazi Party to South America, and although they weren't exclusively in Argentina, in the during the reign of the Perones, there was a lot of activity going on behind the scenes between those that had escaped to Argentina and infiltrated the United States with the assistance of the government, by the way. You want to comment on that at all?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that is very true. I remember that, after Berlin fell on 8th May 1945, the U.S. and the Soviets did away with a lot of the very, very, very best German scientists. I remember that there was an old Bob Hope joke that I think he said on television back in 1957 when somebody asked him, "Hey, Bob, why do you think that the Soviets were able to place a satellite, the Sputnik, in orbit before us Americans?" And Bob Hope said, "Because their Germans are better than our Germans," which I think sort of drove the point that both sides had taken a whole lot of these German scientists to work in America and to work in the Soviet Union. However, as you very correctly mentioned, the government of Juan Perón, who was a very shrewd and very pragmatic politician, I could literally spend hours talking about the good things he did and then spend the same number of hours about this talking about the bad things he did or the wrong things he did. And one of the things that he did do at that time, he said, well, if the Americans are taking all these German scientists and so are the Russians, well, I would like to do the same thing. And he did. And through the Vatican, he brought in many top German scientists. And, for example, there was a point in about 1947-48 where there were three aircraft, the fighter aircraft, actually, that were all based, I think, on one of the MiG models. It wasn't the MiG-219. It was another MiG model. I can't remember the name. German model. I can't remember the name. And the Messerschmitt, one of the Messerschmitt, sorry, yeah. And the Russians used it for their MiG-19, the Americans used it for the F-86 Sabre, and Perón used it for a fighter aircraft called the Pulki. And they were all basically similar aircraft because they were all based on the same original German design. Now, Perón did that shrewdly. He also began a nuclear project in Patagonia, to be exact, because it was based in the city of Bariloche, which is the tourist gateway to Patagonia. It's a very nice city that sits on a beautiful lake down in Bariloche, in Patagonia. So in a way, yes, Argentina did bring in many of those Nazi scientists, many of the Nazi politicians, and it also opened its door to many Jewish refugees, even during the war, at a time when Britain, for example, closed its doors to Jews trying to come into Palestine. And, America was more generous in that sense. But, we still need to write the true history of what really happened during and after the war in many parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was all part of this secret plan to continue the Fourth Reich, which was a cooperation between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany.
Yes, no doubt about it. Although, if you look at sometimes at the Bush family, you would say, "Hey, there they are."
Well, exactly. I mean, I've written about that. So
I know. But there are many signs. For example, even more direct, if I may say, that although on 8th of May 1945 the German armed forces did capitulate to the Allies, to the Soviets, and then to the Americans, the British, and the French. I think it was Admiral Dönitz who was the commander of the submarine commander who did that. And interestingly, the Third Reich never actually capitulated. The armed forces did, but the Reich itself merely dissolved and was later replaced as of 1949 by West Germany and East Germany. There are many indications that not everything fell in May 1945 and that some things got away. For example, something like a number in the region of 100 German submarines, the U-Boote, were never actually accounted for. And it is rumored that many came way down south here, even to Antarctica. And it is official, this is official, that two of those subs the U-977 and the U-530 actually landed in July and August of 1945 on the beaches of Argentina near a city called Mar del Plata, which is our main beachside resort city. It wasn't so big then, but it is a beautiful and very large city now. And also in another resort town called San Clemente del Tuyú, which also lies on the Atlantic. Now, July and August down here are smack in the middle of winter. So there were not many people to actually see that, because those beaches are swarming with people in our southern hemisphere summer, like, you know, December, January, and February. But in July and August, they were very bleak, and it was never quite clear who was on board and what cargoes were actually unloaded from at least those two submarines.
Yeah, we could probably speculate it was gold that was secreted from the train thefts to the Vatican, and then... or possibly from Spain.
Franco's Spain, yes, true. Franco's, the regime of Francisco Franco was neutral during the Second World War, but he did have his long talks with Mr. Hitler, and he did have his strong ties with the Perón regime in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of Patagonia now, your piece, Danger Over Patagonia, and describing in great detail, I mean, it's a very well-written article, very thorough. You're saying that they had designs on this area at least since 1896?
Well, specifically in the case of the international, I mean, Argentina has had, a lot of people have had designs on Argentina, the Brits, the Germans, no doubt, and the Zionist movement, because as I say, the founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, in his book, A Jewish State, which you can, in America, you can get in just about any bookstore. It's a very short book, very interesting reading, actually, very well written, where he proposes that the way to solve the Jewish question, as he called it, was to give the Jews separate, distributed throughout the world, a national homeland. And he said in 1896 the ideal homeland would be naturally Palestine, going back to the Holy Land and so forth. But at the time, that was under the Ottoman Empire and the Sultan in Constantinople, or rather in Istanbul, as it was then called, said, no way, we're not going to give you that land. So Mr. Herzl started looking for options. One, which he discussed with the Brits, with the British, was Uganda, but he personally preferred, very much preferred, Argentina, which, as I say, as I mentioned before, he said it's a very sparsely populated land, which is true, and would have a very great interest in ceding part of their territory to us. Even today, Don, if you look at Patagonia, which is, as I say, it's the southern part of Argentina and Chile, a huge land. In the case of Argentina, it's five provinces, the provinces of Rio Negro, Neuquén, Chubut, Santa Cruz, which means Holy Cross, and Tierra del Fuego, which means fireland. Those five provinces, which look huge on the map, they only have 1.6 million people. If you look at a map of Argentina, one of our most densely populated Buenos Aires suburban areas is a county called La Matanza. It would only appear as a dot on a map of Argentina, and yet that little dot also has 1.6 million people. So we have a very, very lopsided, badly balanced demographic distribution. So right now, Patagonia is extremely vulnerable because there's a totally new mechanism of starting to take it over, and not just by Zionist interest, but it's much wider than that, which has been based on ensuring that there are very liberal, very weak governments always in power, which has been the case in this country for the last 35 or 40 years, and they pass the laws which allow very wealthy people or very wealthy interests to buy huge tracts of land throughout Argentina, especially in Patagonia. And you have guys like George Soros, Ted Turner, Carlo Benetton from Italy, Joseph Lewis from Britain. You have many, many people buying large tracts of land. And you also have organizations that we, under the cover of ecology and trying to, you know, improve or protect the environment and so forth, are also gobbling up huge tracts of land down there.
Mm-hmm. We have a similar phenomenon going on in Paraguay also.
It's pretty much in most countries, in most countries in this region. Even the Brazilians have a similar concern over Amazonia. If you look at Brazil, to understand Brazil, it's very heavily populated on the coastal areas up to about 400 or 500 kilometers or 300-400 miles inland. But then in the middle, it's just a jungle. There's nothing there. It's almost uninhabitable. And the UN has declared both Amazonia in Brazil and Patagonia in Argentina and Chile as theoretically belonging to mankind as a whole, because it has much less than one inhabitant per square kilometer. So in a way, you know, there are many concerns. The Brazilians do a much better job than we do in protecting their stuff, but you know, there is concern. If for instance, in the case of Chile, and this is interesting to point out, there is an American ecologist, a guy who's very concerned about allegedly about the environment, by the name of Douglas Tompkins, and he raised a bit of a fuss in the media in Chile because about 10-12 years ago he bought so much land in Chile that in one point, which is right about halfway down south, he literally split Chile in half, because he bought a huge tract of land going from the Pacific coast to the border with Argentina, which literally split Chile in half, and they almost had to force him to leave two little strips of land open so that a national highway and a provincial highway could go through.
And where do these people get this kind of money to just buy up?
Oh, no, wait. Ted, I'll give you the names again. Carlo and Luciano Benetton, Ted Turner, George Soros. Mm-hmm. George Soros made huge investments here. And, you know, very often, even this whole power system, they make mistakes unwittingly. Because just about 5 years ago, in 2005, our main newspaper, which is called La Nación, it means the nation. Yeah. La Nación is very, very conservative. It's sort of like the New York Times in America, very liberal, very pro-bankers, pro-power structure. Global power structures, they published an article which they regretted called Eduardo Elstein. Eduardo Elstein is a gentleman down here who is George Soros' main representative. Eduardo Elstein, the owner of the land. And they go on to say that they have so much money, the Soros interests have so much money, that they were able to become Argentina's largest landowners. So the guy owns huge tracts of real estate in major cities, huge tracts of real estate near the Paraguayan border, huge tracts of real estate naturally in Patagonia. And when you figure, well, who is this gentleman, Eduardo Elstein? Not only is he, it just shows how the power networks on a global basis works. It's just a small example to understand how power is distributed throughout the world. You can realize that not only is he the Soros man, for the representative for George Soros down here, but he is also a member of the New York-based America Society, founded by David Rockefeller and managed by William Rhodes, which sits right across the street at Park Avenue at 67th Street in New York from the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the treasurer of the World Jewish Congress, named by by his business partner and friend Edgar Bronfman, who sits on the Trilateral Commission and is of Seagram Distillery's fame. He is also a member of the B'nai B'rith Lodge and of the Militant Anti-Defamation League. He also purchased up, when it was privatized, the largest mortgage bank in Argentina. He regularly attends the World Economic Forum. I mean, you have somebody who is really, really very powerful here. And he has business associates like Sam Zell, who's one of the five largest real estate owners in the U.S., Michael Steinhardt, who is an investment fund owner, and he is also one of the most active militants in the Orthodox Jewish movement, Yabad Lubavitch. So when you figure, every time you see a powerful person, he might not say a lot, but when you look at the network, the grid within which he is integrated, American Society, Council on Foreign Relations, World Jewish Congress, Trilateral Commission, the B'nai B'rith Lodge, the Anti-Defamation League, then you realize that even people that you don't particularly find in the newspapers can be extremely powerful. So when you have somebody like that who is very active here in Argentina, I, at least as an Argentine citizen, I start to worry.
Mm-hmm. For the sake of our listeners, and I'm concerned about asking the right questions to allow you to get your underlying message across. So correct me if I'm straying off on a tangent. Here in America, what is becoming really clear to anyone who's studying the problems that we have with the lands and mortgages and the banking system and all the corruption that's going on. We're discovering that all the public lands have been privatized, that the towns and cities across the country are nothing but a conglomeration of some 185,000 corporations, or called in corporations, and they never balance the bank books. They start over the next fiscal year from zero, and you have a lot of disappearing money. Any community that would have a surplus in their general fund just disappears into thin air, and they keep the tax structure going, and they keep levies and bond issues going to keep this revenue stream coming in. A lot of this is fostered by federal laws, which are really very unconstitutional. Are you experiencing that type of thing in Argentina as well?
The mechanism is different, Don, but in a way I would even say that it is worse in America. And I'll tell you why. Because down here in Argentina, you probably remember, well, you're, I don't know how old you are, but you probably remember that there was a time when you had a military coup or takeover in South America like every other day. And we had one in 1955, one in 1961, one in 1966, and the last one was in 1976, which is the one that made a lot of people disappear, and they're the ones who decided to invade the Falkland Islands and so forth. It was really quite dreadful. Now, those guys, one of the really truly bad things they did, which is never out in the newspapers, is that they began what is Argentina's public debt, which has ballooned enormously. And most of it was used against the interests of the Argentinian people by these military and civilians who took power at that time, who usurped power. Now, in 1983, we were finally able to bring back nominally democratic governments, and no more military ever since then. Now, all the democratic governments since from 1983 until today, the first thing they should have done would have been to investigate Argentina's basically or originally illegal public debt. And yet the powers that be will always end up financing, supporting, giving all the necessary prestige and newspaper and media coverage that they need, those local politicians who will do anything, and they're allowed to do anything, all the corruption you can imagine and so forth, as long as they never even think of investigating Argentina's foreign debt, because Argentina's foreign debt is the main instrument that the bankers cabal have to control the country. The IMF come in, all the bankers come in, and what they need to have are people in power here in the presidency and in Congress who will never investigate our debt, but rather roll it over forwards 10, 20, 30, 40 years and keep the bankers very happy with huge interest payments. Now, that has been the excuse in Argentina for what they now call, and they've been calling this for the last 7 or 8 years at least, debt for territory swaps. In other words, since Argentina cannot pay its foreign debt, it's prepared in such a way, it's designed in such a way that year after year we only pay about 2/3 of the interest. Don't even think about the capital. We merely capitalize the interest and roll it over. It will get to a point, and that is, I think, what the banker's long-term objective, where they will say, oh, you guys, you just can't pay your foreign debt. Let's swap debt for territory. And when we had our last major collapse in 2001, 2002, there were literally proposals in this article from the New York Times of the Patagonia seceding from the rest of the country was because it would have been a way of getting a financial compensation which would have reduced our foreign debt. So here they created an artificial excuse, and then for that artificial excuse they created a huge problem, and the Hegelian solution would be, okay, just sell us your land, let us have your land. In America, it's much worse because you don't have that sort of problem. Well, you do. You have a gigantic public debt, but it's not just America's problem. It's America's, it's Europe's, it's Japan's, it's Korea's, it's China's problem. It's the entire planet's problem. And yet, as you very aptly say, they have privatized huge tracts of federal land right in front of your noses, and nobody seems to have been able to do anything about it.
Well, we're going to stay on it. We're not giving up.
Right.
I'm glad you mentioned the Falklands War, because I wanted to get your take on that. You know, what we had reported here in the United States, I don't think was very, very truthful by the media. It was propaganda that we got, and even Wikipedia, as I'm looking at an article, says the conflict was the result of a protracted diplomatic confrontation regarding the sovereignty of the islands. What is your take on the Falklands War?
Well, look, Don, in a way, it's there's, you know, when you go to school, there's a lot of, I was brought up in New York. So, you know, for example, I remember when I was in elementary school, George Washington never told a lie. When he chopped down the cherry tree, he said, "I did it. I cannot tell a lie," and blah, 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 and so forth. There are small historical myths that we are all taught, and they're often very dear to our hearts as to what they really mean. Mm-hmm. And everybody who went to school prior to the Falklands war was told the Falklands or Malvina Islands, they were ours, and they were literally wrenched from us by the Brits in 1840-something, 1840 or 1845, which is true. But they were hardly populated, and there are bleak islands way down south in the South Atlantic. There had been protracted diplomatic negotiations between Argentina and Britain, on and off, but you know how the Brits are. They are excellent diplomats, much better than ours, and they just kept the conversations going decade after decade after decade. This military regime I was talking to you about that usurped power in 1976, there were generals and admirals and Air Force brigadiers, and they sort of succeeded each other. And then in 1981, a new junta came in that was led by an army general by the name of Leopoldo Galtieri. That might ring a bell. That name might ring a bell. And General Galtieri had a lot of domestic problems. And he thought, had no better idea than saying, "I know what I'll do. I'll recover the Falkland Islands and I'll be a hero." And when he did, literally 95% of the population said, "You're on, you're great." All those mass demonstrations and mass rallies you might have seen in the Argentine plazas and squares, they were absolutely spontaneous because people felt, you know, this, I don't care if it's the military or the politicians, they did the right thing, you know, a lot of flag waving and so forth. But it was the most stupid thing that could have possibly have been done, because anybody who thinks that you can wrench something away from Britain and they're just going to lie around and do nothing about it has not read history properly. And the result was that we ended up going to war, not just with Britain, where you can say, well, you know, they have a long logistical problem from London to the Falkland Islands, but against America. Because America, that was Ronald Reagan at the time in the States and Margaret Thatcher in Britain. There has been an ongoing, and there still is, an ongoing military and political alliance that goes back to before the First World War. So how can that possibly break down on account of a stupid little old Argentina in the hands of a bunch of, you know, military officers? So the inevitable happened. Britain was able to fight that war because they had all of its logistics catered for by Caspar Weinberger, who at the time was the Secretary of Defense for Ronald Reagan, and they were able to wrench the islands back. However, we have to read this properly. It wasn't also flag waving on the part of Britain, although there was a lot of flag waving. You know, the people will always do that. Mm-hmm. But the Falklands have very strong strategical importance because there is a lot happening and a lot will be happening in Antarctica, which is a huge continent with incalculable reserves of oil, mineral, potable water, fish, food, everything you can possibly think of that mankind will need from now on. And the Falklands is basically now, it's a British base, off hands for everybody except the Americans. And it is an unsinkable aircraft carrier which is there to defend not so much the Falkland Islands themselves, but British and American and other interests in Antarctica, and British and American and Israeli interests in Patagonia. I remember about 10 or 12 years ago, it's a shame I didn't actually write down the date. In one of your, I was in America, in one of your shows, I think it was 60 Minutes or Meet the Press, there was an interview with Henry Kissinger. Sir Henry Kissinger, I should say. And at the end of the interview, the host was told Henry, let's make a ping pong of questions. I say a word and you give me your impression. And one of the words he said was Argentina. And Henry stopped for a minute and said, "It's a dagger pointing at Antarctica." And I said, wow, this guy really knows his geopolitics. Patagonia, aside from its own huge riches in minerals and oil and wind power and fish and arable land and so forth, also has a very, very, very important strategic location, geostrategic location, I should say, vis-a-vis Antarctica. And this is something that was very well understood by the Brits, very well understood by the Zionist movement, very well understood by America, and very well understood by the geopoliticians like Mr. Haushofer from the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like Guam is to Southeast Asia,
right?
The United States as a staging area, as a potential base.
Rallying point, yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, boy, there's so many questions I want to ask. What is the main point that you would like to communicate in regard, you know, to this massive article you wrote, and where you see things headed, what has to happen, you know, all these questions are popping up simultaneously.
Well, yeah, Don, you know, the reason I wrote that article was basically for two reasons. First of all, to bring, I know that in the English language there's practically no information about these sort of more local problems. So I said, you know, I thought I'd bring that all together because, for example, quoting again our main and most respectable newspaper, La Nación, in January 1986, they published an article where they admit that there are Israeli officers who go around dressed as hippies and as hitchhikers and so forth, and they literally admitted, one of their spokesmen admitted that what they were doing was surveying the lands of Patagonia, especially an area called El Calafate, way down south in Santa Cruz province, to see if that would be a suitable place, if you study the climate, the vegetation, the animals, and the potential wealth of the area for future settlements of Israeli and Jewish people. And I mean large settlements. And they very keenly said, yes, it is great, and we'd love to do that. And then you fast forward, that was in 1986. When you fast forward a little bit to the more recent years, 2003, I think it was, yeah, one of our former general staff army commanders, the General Roberto Bendini, he said in a private, and I emphasize, private meeting, that he was concerned about the Israelis who I'm literally reading from, again, La Nación, our main newspaper here. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt, General Bendini said, that there are Israelis all over the Patagonia. They move around in groups. They are young. They speak in Hebrew amongst themselves. And a good number of them come from the military. They have just taken off their Israeli army uniforms. And, you know, they're again, 20-something-year-old youths who are taking their alleged vacations after leaving the Israeli army and before going to college. And they come around and they do their surveys down in Patagonia. So you figure, this is something to be concerned about. And local Zionist interests here have so much power that they were able to literally twist the arm of the government and force the Army General Staff Commander General Roberto Bendini to resign. So I figure, you know, it would be a good idea for people to understand that that is happening here, because when you tie it in with, for example, what many people in your country, in America, feel is excessive power, for example, from AIPAC, from the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, in a book written by Stephen Wald, former dean of the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and John Mearsheimer from Chicago University. They wrote a book in 2007, I think it was, called U.S. Foreign Policy and the Israeli Lobby, where he says they wield so much power, Zionist interests, that they can literally twist the arm of the American government. And in one part of his book, he says, so much so that our foreign policy ends up giving more importance to the national security of Israel than to the national security of the United States of America. Now, these are very powerful concepts, and you figure if that's happening in America, it's been happening in Europe for a long time. We see the mess that the Middle East is in, and the mess that America and Britain are in the Middle East. And then you see that something similar is happening in Argentina. I figure it's a way of helping to understand how this whole power structure, this global power structure, really works and what its constituent parts are. Now, I'm not going to say that it's the Zionists running the world, because, I mean, that would be a ridiculous simplification. But they are an integral and very powerful part of the global power elite. And to understand this will help you you understand why certain things in the world are happening, and at least to be alert to the mechanisms of this power, this global power structure.
Mm-hmm. Now, is Patagonia experiencing any of the problems, let's say, that you have in Bolivia or Colombia or even Paraguay, in terms of drug smuggling, any organized crime, anything like that?
That's the beauty of it. Basically, Patagonia is anybody you run into in Patagonia who's an Argentine or a Chilean citizen has probably gone there only in the last 20, 30, maybe 40, 50 years at most. It's a relatively young and recent population. People have moved out there, but as I say, in small numbers. The entire Argentine side of Patagonia only has 1.6 million people. It's a very low population. There's no drug problem. There is a very small security problem, as you would have in any town, because there are no large cities to begin with, and definitely not a center for drugs as Bolivia and Colombia have been for years, or for smuggling and so forth as Paraguay is particularly apt because of the fact that they are so close to two much larger countries, Brazil on the east and Argentina on the south. So that is one of the reasons why it is such an attractive area. It's underpopulated, almost unpopulated in certain areas. It's immensely rich, and it has little or no problems. That's why they're never in the news. Like, you never hear in the news, a drug cartel has been attacked in Patagonia. They just don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Or school shootings or things like that.
Nothing of the sort. Yeah, which you read about in Mexico, which are so dreadful. You know, I mean, the things you read about in Mexico, it puts your hair on end.
Yes. The one reason why I asked that question, I'm getting a few messages in on the chat window. There are some folks wondering if you, and this may be a bit out of line in terms of our current conversation, but you just mentioned what a nice place Patagonia is. In terms of someone looking for what they can consider to be a safe and independent place where they can live freely, would that be such a place?
Well, I get a lot of messages like that, Don, because why if Ted Turner, Benetton, Soros, the Bush family, and many others are thinking of Argentina in general and Patagonia in particular as a nice place to have some large tract of land just in case, well, it's the obvious question for just about anybody in America. If anything, with the troubling times that are increasingly on the horizon in North America and in Europe and elsewhere also throughout the world, South America as a whole is an area which has relatively much far less problems than potential problems looking towards the future than other parts of the world. And within South America, Argentina and Brazil are particularly attractive because Argentina, if you've ever seen photographs of Buenos Aires, you say, oh, what a huge city it is. It's something like 13 or 14 million people. And there you have the very gist of the problem and the attractiveness of Argentina, depending on which side you look at it. Because we have about 42 million people, but very badly distributed throughout the country. So one-third of the population live in Buenos Aires and greater Buenos Aires. If you then take our 5 or 10 main cities, you have about 80% of the population. So the result is that the bulk of the country, even near Buenos Aires, is totally, I wouldn't say totally uninhabited, but it is very sparsely uninhabited. And that makes it very interesting. If you're a wealthy person and you want to found new cities and you want to found new places, well, this would be the place to go. And it would even be in Argentina's interest, because if you were to ask me, what do you rather have, a Chinese flocking into Argentina and populating Argentina, or would you prefer to have Europeans and Americans? Well, I would tell you, well, naturally, Europeans and Americans. I mean, we are all basically of European stock, albeit mostly Italian and Spanish, but we come from there. But it definitely is, to answer the listener's question, it definitely is a very attractive option for anybody who has the chance of saying, hey, I'd like to have a second place somewhere out in the world shaded under a tree. Well, Argentina definitely is a place to take it to consider and to keep in mind.
Yeah. Now, with all the interest in the infrastructure and the assets, the mineral rights and oil and what have you, the riches of the land. Is that an expensive place to live, or is it can it be considered modest or even quite affordable?
Well, expensive depends on what currency you have your assets in and how those currencies will fare in the future. Right now, if you come to Argentina with U.S. dollars or euros, you'll find it to be a very cheap place. You'll be able to get a very good house, a very good apartment, a good car, a good meal, groceries and so forth at a fraction of what you would pay in U.S. dollars in America or in Europe. From our point of view, since our salaries are mostly in pesos, you know, things get expensive and things can get rather difficult. And they tend to be slightly more expensive down south because of the logistics of actually carrying, I don't know, groceries, food, meat, whatever it is that you're going to buy. But it is not particularly expensive, and one of the things that that concerns me, for example, as an Argentinian, is that, as I say, Patagonia has immense wealth. If I put all of Argentina into the picture, you know, the wealth of Argentina as a country is almost incalculable. We have the sixth largest territory in the world, and yet we're only 40 million people. And you would expect, well, you know, we shouldn't be 40 million. We should be 140 million, 240 million. Successive mistakes and treason by our own politicians, coupled with the global power elite's long-term objectives, have kept this country very underpopulated. So if anything, one of the main, and this is why I wrote that article, one of the main risks that we run is as the global government or the world government starts getting stronger and stronger, we're going to be asked the question, the following question, which I don't think anybody will be able to reply in Argentina. If we are 40 million people, that represents about 0.7% of global population. Global population right now is about 6.8 billion. Now, why is it that with less than 1% of the population, we have the sixth largest territory in the world? We have six times more territory than France that houses 70 million people. So when the global power elite or the coming world government asks us or tell us, hey, we're going to redistribute territory in the interest of peace, mankind, human rights, democracy, freedom, or whatever, what are we going to tell them? Because they're going to say, you know, Patagonia is just too big for you guys, so we're going to take it over. But they're not going to take it over the way as happened with Iraq, with a military invasion. I envision that all they need to do is put into power, through the power of money, local governments here in the executive branch and the congressional branch that will sanction the necessary law whereby sometime in the near future the whole Patagonia might be concessioned out to a gigantic joint venture of oil companies, mining companies, insurance companies, defense contractors, and so forth, and they will found, I call it Patagonia Inc., Incorporated, or Patagonia Limited, depends on how you want to look at it, and they will have the concession for 99 or 999 years, it won't make any difference, and Patagonia, which will be formally under Argentinian jurisdiction, will in fact and in practice be controlled by the global corporations and the global power elite. I remember David Rockefeller, again, a couple of years back, said, we don't want to own everything. We just want to control everything. So you have to look at it from the point of view of the global power elite. They already own the whole bloody planet. I mean, they know that. They own everything. So they don't have to go around saying everybody and rubbing in front of your face, hey, Argentinians, we own your country. No. If it'll make you happy, you own it. Put your little flags all over the place. I mean, they don't have any flag themselves anyway, so they don't give a damn what flag is waving in Patagonia or elsewhere. As long as they control, as long as it's the Benettons, the Turners, the Soros, the Rockefellers, the Rhodes, the Bushes controlling the area, they'll let us have whatever flag we want.
Yeah, that opens up a whole Pandora's box of questions. I won't even go there for now. it's always the same players, isn't it? How wary or aware, conscious of these issues is the average Argentine, would you say?
Very little. very little. That's why I raise such a fuss, and I try to do a lot of that. And every time a crisis comes about, we try to double our efforts. I don't know if you heard, but last 27th October, the former president of Argentina died, Mr. Kirchner, Néstor Kirchner. And the importance of that, I mean, you figure, well, he's a former president. No, wait a second. He is the husband of the present president of Argentina, Mrs. Cristina Kirchner, whom he dumped on us, literally, 3 years ago. So, you know, he was an extremely powerful person. He was actually calling the shots permanently behind the scenes. So the fact that he's gone, from our point of view, means that we can, a whole new panorama or vistas open up, and we are trying to promote our second republic movement, as we call it down here, so that people will become aware of that. Down here, we have a perverse triangle, as I call it, which is the same one you have in America. The people in power do not defend the interests of we the people. The false opposition, who are just in the sidelines waiting for their turn, they also do not defend the interests of we the people. And the third part of that perverse triangle are the mainstream media, who will talk about anything except the key issues, and who will only let people speak in their cameras and into their microphones the people that they want. If Don Nikoloff has good ideas as how to put America back on its feet, well, fine, you can do so, but Fox News is not going to interview you regularly. CNN, ABC, CBS, and NBC are not going to interview you regularly, so the bulk of the American public will not know Don Nikoloff's solutions to American problems, because the mainstream media just won't carry it. Well, this is exactly the same thing down here, but maybe we have a bit of a more fighting chance, because we're a much more volatile country. Although power here is very structured, it's still quite unstable, and every time there is a crisis, it can represent an opening where you can sort of slip your way through, maybe with greater ease than you would be able to do so in America or in a European country.
Mm-hmm. I presume you probably have a similar percentage of your population there in Argentina that is awake or conscious and paying attention to what's going on beyond, let's say, any militant attitude. You know, we're talking about having a grasp of the nature of the banking system, and I think we all face the same issues, the food problems, pharmaceutical drugs, energy, and power production, and then all the incidental costs that go along. You're saying you don't necessarily have the inflation, but you have these world powers trying to move in, posture themselves to control the nation's assets. How do the people feel about that?
Yeah, there is a substantial sector of public opinion that are very concerned about that, and we have perhaps the advantage over America and Europe that we've lived through it. I think I mentioned this in the last time we spoke in a previous program. I'm 58, and my adult life, I've gone through three collapses. 1975, which was the weakest one. It wasn't that bad. 1989, we had hyperinflation, and that is murder to live with. And then in 2001, 2002, our very worst collapse. It was a gigantic banking, monetary, and financial collapse. GDP fell by 40%, and 50% of the population fell below the poverty line, and most of it never came back. So people, when that happens to you, you start scratching your head and you start saying, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here? So a lot of people have become aware. If anything, one of the dangers that at least I try to neutralize is that a lot of people here who see these things, they have a tendency to be flag-waving nationalists, which means that they're a little bit closed and boxed in, and they will only think of Argentina should save itself. And I think, wait a second, sure, I like Argentina, like you like America or California or whatever, but it's all the countries in our region that have the same basic problems. And on top of it, in this part of the world, we are something like 12 countries with basically the same language, the same history, even the same national heroes. San Martin, who is our national liberator, is also the liberator of Chile and of Peru. So, you know, in a way, we have to, I try to warn people not to take that bigoted, close-minded, nationalist, flag-waving attitude, because let's face it, we are in the year 2010, and things are very different, and either we all have the same enemy, and you in America, me in Argentina, we both have basically the same problem. We might speak a different language, or we live far away from each other, but we have the same ideas, the same problems, and we can do a lot working together to solve those same problems, instead of saying, oh, you could do your thing in America, and we'll do our thing in Argentina.
No, most of us are not for global governance, but I have no problem in interfacing with people from other countries. I did that for a number of years in Europe and other parts of the world, I should say. And, you know, we have communication barriers, language barriers, customs. The governments are set up differently under political ideologies that are part of the propaganda and the indoctrination in the schools and even in religion. I guess we share a common bond in the fact that we've both been infiltrated with escapees from World War II and World War I, you know. I guess the main question, you know, how sensitive are those issues to the people? Do the people that are moving into Patagonia, trying to take control of its assets, pose a threat to Argentinians in a general sense, or do they resent this takeover? Those that know.
Some of them do, and they very often do it foolishly, Don, because if anything, we're a country that was like America. We were built with immigration. I'm the grandson of an Italian immigrant after the First World War, and all of us are immigrants one way or another. As a whole, we are a very generous people in the sense that we are not bigoted because somebody comes in from another country. What there is growing concern is when all of a sudden somebody like this guy Eduardo Elsan I was talking about before, or Ted Turner, or George Soros, they buy huge tracts of land. And for example, in Bariloche, which is down south in Patagonia, we used to have public lakes and beautiful public lakes and public mountains that are now cordoned off because they are private property. So people do resent when the usual place they used to go have their vacations now has a sign saying no trespassing private property. But aside from that, people here do not in any way resent people coming in from abroad. If anything, and this is one of the things that I think, you know, we have to make a qualitative leap, in our Second Republic project, and I want to mention this because you just said something very important. One of the first things that we say, and we call it the first pillar, is to restore our sovereign nation states. Because as you say, we have to work together as peoples, not global governance, not a global government, but Americans in America, Argentinians in Argentinians, Brits in Britain. We need to work together as sovereign peoples, and the sovereign nation state, and the Council on Foreign Relations has been harping on this in the Trilateral Commission for decades. The sovereign nation state has been eroded in America, in Argentina, and today it has become basically a colonial administration entity. So you think you vote for a president, and you think that Obama is the most powerful man in the world, but you know better than I do, Obama is not the most powerful man in the world. He is basically the CEO, the chief executive officer of the United States of America, Inc., as Mrs. Kirchner down here is the CEO, the chief executive officer of Argentina. When you realize that all our allegedly sovereign presidents are CEOs, then you have to ask yourself, if they're the CEO, who sits on the on the board of directors of America? And above that, who are the shareholders of America, who are the real owners of the country? The same goes for Argentina. So as we resolve those problems and we take our countries back, which starts by reinstating our sovereign nation states, then those independent sovereign states can work together towards common purposes and to neutralize common enemies who are the very people who want to set up global governance and global government.
Yeah. Just taking control of everything, power and control. And
exactly.
And they're doing it with paper printed out of thin air.
On top of that, yeah. This is very foolish.
Is your economy, and this may sound like a dumb question, but is your economy basically the same as what we have here in the United States? You're very familiar with the Fed and
Oh, yeah. It's almost an exact copy. And if anything, you know, this country originally was a colony of Spain. We became, quote-unquote, independent in 1810 of Spain. But the price of that was that we became a financial and economic colony of Britain. And that lasted and was even stable because the economy of Britain and the economy of 19th century and early 20th century Argentina were very complementary. In other words, they had a lot of industrial and technology that we didn't have, and we had a lot of raw materials that they didn't have. So it was sort of complementary. However, when after the Second World War, we became an economic and financial colony, to say it somehow, of America, things got very tough because the economy of Argentina and the economy of the United States are very similar. We are on a much smaller scale, but we have huge amounts of raw materials. We have huge potential for industrialization, as America was able to achieve. And naturally, on the monetary side, we have a central bank, which is, just to give you an example, it was designed in 1935 by a gentleman sent here by the governor of the Bank of England. His name at the time was Montague Norman, and he sent a German by the name of Otto Niemeyer from the Reichsbank. This was during Hitler's time, actually. Otto Niemeyer, 1935, and he designed a central bank which was almost a carbon copy of the Bank of England. So they have full control of our money. And our last collapse in 2001, 2002, one of the causes was that we had a very stupid president by the name of Fernando de la Rúa, who had to resign only 2 years into the office because he did not monetize the economy, and everything collapsed. As the Federal Reserve admits that they worsened the 1930s depression after 1929 because they withdrew one-third of the money in circulation.
Well, that's pretty much like what we have here.
You have the same, yeah, I know.
You have the same games going on. Where do you see the economy headed in Argentina, if I can ask you that question?
Well, yeah, it is a very interesting question. Our economy is basically intact and with huge potential. And if anything, the 2008 crisis has affected Argentina less in relative terms, and even all of South America less, because we, especially Argentina, were forcibly broken away from the global financial system in 2001, 2002. We fell into a hole. So as we recovered, and as recovery came about, because we're so bloody rich, we say that no matter how hard successive presidents tried to sink Argentina, none of them have achieved it because we're such a very potentially rich country. So when the crisis broke out in 2008, we were able to weather it much better. And if anything, we still have bouts of inflation, and we still have bouts of problems all over of all sorts, but it has been in relative terms much milder than you would find in Europe or in America. And the main problem we have right now is that the whole system to control Argentina is based on our having a public debt that is never fully investigated and that is constantly rolled over. And that foreign debt, which is almost unpayable, has been the excuse to impose upon us reforms of the state, reforms of the educational system, widespread privatization at really vile rock bottom prices of our oil company, electricity company, gas company, mining companies, and so forth, so that all our public utilities that were in the hands of the state are now fully in the hands of private corporations, and they do whatever the hell they want. They have so much power that in 2006, Chile and Argentina signed a treaty whereby a whole area on the Andes Mountains, which is on the border of Argentina and Chile, was literally concessioned out to corporations and given limited sovereignty. So Barrick Gold, for example, they can do whatever the hell they want in their region because they do their own, they make their own laws. So if anything, the way the mechanism works down here is that they finance the local politicians who then become presidents and senators and deputies and so forth, so that they know that the laws will always be in their favor and naturally against the people. So people can complain, they can bitch around, they can say, oh, this is terrible. And okay, they are allowed to do so, but nevertheless, the powerful people and the powerful corporations are the ones that are calling the shots.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a poverty rate of at least 50%. Is that a result of a lack of jobs, or is that just low wages?
It's a combination of both. It's a lack of jobs and wages. So we don't have proper statistics because, you know, the government is permanently fiddling around with statistics. But it's basically because our economy is geared in such a way that what you have is a relatively strong middle and upper middle class who are the managers that the corporations need to do all the technological and all the administrative and all the management stuff and so forth. And then you have the rest of the population that, from the point of view of the global power elite, well, they're there, and let's sort of tolerate them. Let's try and sort of use them as a market. But they really have – it's very difficult for them to have any insertion into the economy as it is geared now, because it is not geared on giving jobs to everybody. It is geared on doing certain types of business, especially those related to the agricultural and raw materials and mining and oil and so forth, which are then exported. Whomever we can incorporate of the local workforce into that, wonderful. That's quite a number, about 10 or 12 million people. And the rest, well, the rest, they're poor. Let's try to sort of manage them with putting them into shanty towns. A lot of drugs serve that purpose, and naturally the mainstream entertainment media that keep uncultured people more or less under control, which is something that also happens in America, especially among certain ethnic groups.
Oh, if you didn't use the word Argentina, I would think you were talking about the United States.
New York.
Yes, yeah. It's a problem everywhere. The problem here is the rule of law, and it's corruption. It's been designed to protect the corporate interests and the corrupt politicians who all come out of the legal profession, or the majority who come out of the legal profession.
Same here. You know what the main difference between America and Argentina would be, aside from the scale, like, I don't know, you're 1,000 or 100 times bigger than we are in just about everything you do, is the fact that you are the actual local place where the corporations where they operate from, and we are a periphery, we are a fringe, we are a marginal area where the corporations come here, gobble up what they want, and then they leave. George Soros is a prime example. He came in 1995 and left after the crisis in 2005, and he openly declared, my 10 years in Argentina gave me profits of almost $1 billion. So he came, he saw, he conquered, he got his money, and he left. Whilst in America, you are the headquarter territory for many, many of these companies, although some of them are moving out, like Halliburton, that moved out into Dubai. But, you know, this is a global power structure. They have no nationality. They have no flag. They couldn't give a hoot about America, Britain, Germany, Italy, Argentina, or whatever. They sort of say, well, where is the best place to be? So from the business point of view, the best place to be until recently is America or London. Where should I have my headquarters? Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. But if things get really tough there, they're already thinking, well, where should I flee for a while? Patagonia, Chile, Brazil. And when things sort of even out or calm down, maybe I'll come back to Europe. Maybe I'll come back to America. We should never think, and I say this to a lot of people down here, we should never think in terms of these Americans, these Brits, these Germans, or these Argentinians, because it doesn't work that way. These people have no nationality. And it's very foolish to say, oh, the enemy of Argentina are the Americans or the Brits, because the peoples, we the people, wherever they are never enemies. It's their ruling elites that can be enemy of amongst themselves. From my point of view, one of our main enemies are not the Americans or the Brits, for example, but the Argentine ruling elite.
Yeah, well, we have the same problem here with our government and their permissiveness to allow criminals to sneak over the border undocumented and set them up and leech off of the system that everyone else paid into. You know, our Social Security has collapsed many years ago. They just, you know, these are line item entries in a second or third set of books that are kept. Even though we have a comprehensive annual financial report out of, you know, generated out of these 185,000 municipalities across the nation, they zero the books every year. I would presume that you probably have a similar problem.
Absolutely. You know, the problems are so much the same that you start to realize, and one of the things that you start to understand when you scratch your head and you look at these things and you listen to all these examples, that this is a global model that is then reproduced locally, tropicalized locally as per and in accordance with local condition. I'll give you an example that shows this very clearly. Argentina, because of the Perón regime, has very good social laws. For example, they've been downgraded now, but we've had always free hospitals and very good ones at that. And I remember a few years back, there was a tourist company in Peru that had a tourist tour where people who had ailments should come to them, make a tour of Argentina, have themselves treated in Argentinian hospitals, and then they were shipped back to Peru like a tour, like a charter.
Well, I can see a lot of politicians wanting to come there for birth certificates.
Naturally, this tourist company had the politicians in their payroll, and they had everybody in their payroll to make sure that this could be done with ease.
Mm-hmm. From your perspective, how can we in America help the people in Argentina? And of course, I'm speaking about those people who are awake, who are facing exactly the same problem. And conversely, do you see a way that Argentina can help America?
Yes, it works both ways. And let's start with the really important stuff. America still, in spite of all the problems you have, still calls the shots in the world. So, you know, whatever happens in America affects the entire world. Whatever happens in Argentina affects Argentinians. Every time we had a collapse, our border sort of literally closed off. And everybody outside would just look at us and sort of laugh and say, look at these Argentinians. They're fighting with hyperinflation. They're fighting with banking collapse, you know, to hell with them sort of thing. When that happens in America, it is a problem for the world. Now, where America can help is that, and you're a prime example of that, is as public opinion grows increasingly aware within America. That's why I started doing these English videos, to see if, you know, if I can pitch in and help give my own little helping hand there. The more public opinion understands this, the more that America will change. And with America changing, a lot of other countries will automatically change and for the better. And what we can do in that two-way flow movement is we have a lot of practical knowledge of how these things work. For you, the last depression, the 1930s, for Americans, it's a black and white picture of people queuing up to get a dish of soup at a community kitchen. For us, it's something that we lived, as I say, I'm 58 and I lived three times through it in my adult life. So, for example, one of the things that when looking at your global financial collapse of 2008, you realize that Americans are starting to come to terms with the fact that it wasn't Bernie Madoff who had a Ponzi pyramid scheme. The entire global financial system based out of America and London is a pyramid. And like every good pyramid, it has four sides. The first side is to control the issuing of your public currency, the Fed in your case, the Argentine Central Bank in ours, so that it never gives the right amount of cash that the economy really needs. The second side of the pyramid is to replace the lack of good public sane money with banking funny money, which is based on the fractional lending system and which charges interest being the main cause of inflation. The third side of this pyramid is that they have talked us all, especially in America, into thinking that if, as an individual, a corporation or a government, you want to do something, you have to do it with debt. You have to indebt yourself for 5, 10, 50, 100 years in the future. And the fourth and most perverse side of the pyramid is that the powers that be know that this is a model that they're imposing on us, and that all models have an internal mechanism. And that internal mechanism is that when the whole system is in the growth mode, they activate the private channels so that all the goodies, all the monies go into the private people that they, and corporations and interests that they want. And when it gets to a point where the system is just going to collapse, they automatically activate new channels where they socialize all the losses. They privatize the profits and then they socialize the losses. What else is taxpayer bailout of the big banks? What else is the Fed with quantitative easing one and now quantitative easing two, whereby they issue huge amounts of public money, which means that they are eroding the dollar and they are making Americans and the rest of the world pay for the bankers' crimes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's insanity to proclaim that you can get rid of the debt by imposing more debt on the debt.
Absolutely, absolutely. Any housewife will tell you how to balance a budget, but you know Washington can't seem to come to grips with that.
Yeah, exactly. And we have the technological means to solve those problems, but they're using it for their own enrichment. You see, and it's very corrupt. Your five pillars that you mentioned, if I may be so blunt as to read these off to the listeners. And you mentioned restore the sovereign state, recover a sovereign currency is your second pillar. Third pillar, reject the debt-based economic system, which we just now discussed. Reinvigorate our republican institutions and return to traditional values. They're selling globally, they're selling this concept of democracy, although Our nation here in the United States is a republic. It's a constitutional republic. What we have these backdoor deals that were done several hundred years ago and modified as time went on, sort of like changing the rules of the game. In American football, you have to go 10 yards to get a first down, but the rules allow you to get first downs when there's a penalty or when they want to make a ridiculous call. They're actually conditioning us, even through professional sports, to accept irrational judgment and conclusions based on what we see with our own eyes.
That's called predicting warfare.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason I mention all of these, because you are proposing a second republic. You're not asking for a democracy, which is a word which sort of masks its true reality, which is socialism and or communism, fascism, Zionism. Your thoughts on that, Adrian?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm very thankful to you that you actually read out those five pillars for a second republic. If anything, just for you to know, we are setting up the second republic project in English, because I'm doing that with actually one of the colleagues we're working on this with is G. Edward Griffin, whom I was honored to share a panel in America at the beginning of this year. So he's helping out. And there's a site there called www.secondrepublicproject, altogether, secondrepublicproject.com, where we're starting to put a lot of this material in there. And the fourth pillar of Second Republic, which refers to reinvigorating the Republican institutions, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, is that whether it be in America or in Argentina, how does any individual, anybody who's listening to us right now, how does he become or she become senator of the United States, congressman or congresswoman of the United States, or president of the United States? Easy. You got to have a lot of money, either your own money or somebody, some corporation's money, or even drug dealer money in the cases of many countries throughout South America. Because the only way that you can rise from total anonymity, nobody knows you, and be able to bring your message out to 40 million Argentinians or 318 million Americans and say, if I were president of the United States, I, Don Nikoloff, would do this, 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 and that, and I would change that, 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 and that much. The only way that you can reach them is through the media. And the media costs hundreds of millions of dollars for you to be on the newspaper, on television, on radio, for your picture to appear all over the place, to have all those big rallies, to have all those big campaigns, all the infrastructure to become president or senator or congressman or congresswoman. That requires huge amounts of money, whether it be in America or in Argentina. So let's not talk about democracy. The powers of that be, the money power, if you were to tell them, hey, what's your favorite system? They would say the present democratic system, because we could control it with money. We put some money into the local Republican, we put some money into the local Democrat, and whoever wins will have to bow down to us because I finance your campaign. So in the long run, what America has, what Argentina has, is the best democracy that money can buy.
Mm-hmm.
I was mentioning the other day in a radio program down here, because we had the present president of Argentina, Cristina Kirchner, who was elected actually earmarked by her now dead husband. That was back in 2007. She had two scandals. One scandal was that a suitcase was intercepted at Ezeiza Airport coming from Hugo Chavez in Venezuela with $800,000 cash. And when the guy got caught by the airport police, he said, "It's here for Christina." And they found out there were something like 20 pieces of luggage that were containing hard cash inside of them. One example of how campaigns are financed here. Second example, there was a very nasty crime with people who were front drug companies, but they were really for other types of drugs, cocaine and so forth, and they had all contributed to the campaign for the election of Cristina Kirchner. So one of the things we say down here is, in the worst of cases, what democracy does, it puts in power the candidates of organized crime. And in the best of cases, what it can do, and we have two very rich candidates down here right now who say, "Oh no, I don't need to tap into that money. I'm rich myself and I can do it with my own money." So the very, very, very best thing that this democracy can offer to the people is a government of the rich, of the richest. Okay, George Bush probably can say, "I've got my own money." George Soros, if he wants to run for president, would say, "I don't need to tap into anybody's money. I've got my own money," which means that this is a democracy in the best of cases for the very wealthy people. But what about you and me? What about the people who are listening now?
Yeah, and how did those people get that money?
That's another question, yes.
Serving the people.
The Bushes, especially who had ties with the Nazis through Brown Brothers Harriman before and during the Second World War.
Yes, exactly. When I was doing research on the Bushes, and I came across Otto Skorzeny's deathbed confessions, he was probably the most notorious Nazi assassin, alternatively described as a bodyguard of Hitler, and the individual that masterminded the rescue of Mussolini.
Yes, exactly.
He was very tight, we'll say, very close to Eva Perón, and she bequeathed him $100 million. And Skorzeny claimed that Bush Sr. stole that money. And therefore, to get back at him, he was going to reveal many secrets. He described her passing and that she was buried in Italy. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Yes. Yeah. Then she was repatriated back to Argentina in the 1970s. But her first burial place. You see, Perón, the first government of Juan Perón, should have gone on until 1958, and yet he was ousted by unfortunately, a very pro-U.S. and CIA-backed military coup in 1955. And one of the first things they did is they made the body of Eva Perón, who had died in 1952, she was considered almost as a saint, it was very quietly shipped out to Rome, to a very discreet little chapel in Rome. When Perón is able to come back to the presidency in 1973, her body is repatriated to Argentina.
Yes, and Skorzeny said that he literally affected that recovery of her body.
Yeah,
he participated himself in going there and retrieving her casket.
You know, as we said a while back in this conversation, it would be very, very interesting to really investigate and write the true history of many of the things that occurred during the war and after the war in America, in Germany, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Paraguay, because the final history and the final story is yet to be written about many things which might be annoying in a first instance, but then you figure, well, there might have been a reason, even a justification for that. And in other cases, it involves people way, way at the top, like the Bushes and many others. You had some people like General Gehlen setting up the CIA practically. So, and you had Wild Bill Donovan doing a lot of talking with people over in the other side in Germany. And one of the most unwritten and probably the scariest for the Zionists, from the Zionist point of view, stories. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why Eichmann, Adolf Eichmann, was kidnapped in Buenos Aires in the 60s, shipped off to Israel, and then executed, is because Eichmann was one of the main officers in the German SS who were in dealings, very, very intense dealings with the Zionists, and they had reached many agreements because they both had a common interest. The Germans wanted to get rid of the Jews from Europe, and the Zionists wanted to get the Jews out of Europe and into Israel. Or into Palestine, I should say, at the time. So they were a bit of a pain in the neck for the Brits, and that's why the Zionist terrorist groups like the Irgun Zwei Leumi, led by Menachem Begin, and the Stern Gang, as they were called by the Brits, led by Yitzhak Shamir, targeted British interests. Actually, they blew up the King David Hotel, where the British had their military command in Palestine, in Jerusalem, in 1946, I think it was. And they killed something like 100 top officers, because their main enemy were not the Germans, incredibly, but the Brits. Who wouldn't let them in? Who wouldn't let them into Palestine? They wanted to bring as many Jews into Palestine. And the German, the Third Reich, was saying, the SS specifically, sure, take them. But then it was the British who were not allowing them in. And that is one of the many untold stories, and it explains why Eichmann had to be carted out of Argentina and had to be executed. Because if he were to have spoken, he would have really said a lot of very uncomfortable things. Same with Rudolf Hess, who was he was Hitler's number two, who was kept alive and as the sole prisoner in Spandau prison in Berlin until the late 80s, and he was probably executed by the he was a very old man already by the British. It actually happened. He committed suicide. A 90-year-old man who hangs himself with a bit of wire hanging from a window. He committed suicide allegedly because it was already known in 1987 that the Soviet Union was about to fall, and the only excuse for keeping Rudolf Hess in prison was because the Soviets allegedly wouldn't agree to releasing him. And if he were to be released, he would have given a very different story, I'm sure, of what actually happened between Germany and Britain during the Second World War. And when Rudolf Hess' son wanted to bring a press conference right after the death of his father, he had a mental breakdown, that he had a mental stroke, and he could never recover from that. So there's a lot of things that I think are worth delving into more deeply, because official history does not always reflect things the way they really are.
Yes, you're correct, and I agree with you. It's all of this was carried out under an invisible Ashkenazi flag.
Yep.
And the British royalty themselves were Ashkenazis, changing their name under George V from Battenberg to Mountbatten.
Exactly, during the First World War. If anything, the Ashkenazim, as you aptly mentioned them, they are something like 90% of the Israeli political and ideological leadership, and they can't even trace their ancestry back to the Hebrews or the Jews of the Bible. They come from the Khazars, which was a tribe, a Central Asian tribe that converted en masse as a whole to Judaism in the year 740, because they were like a roaming empire, and the caliphate in Baghdad wanted to convert them to Islam, and the Christians in Constantinople in the Western Roman Empire wanted to convert them to Christianity. So these guys decided neither one nor the other will convert to Judaism. The only mass conversion in 740 AD of an entire peoples into Judaism. But the Ashkenazim, who are their descendants, have no genetic ties with the Jews and the Hebrews of the Bible.
Yes.
The Sephardites do. The Sephardites do, but not the Ashkenazim.
Back then, they were called the Mon, and even prior to that, the Bon of Tibet.
Yes, exactly. Prior to Buddhism, the Bon, yes. who have very, very weird ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. You could say it's the stronghold of the ancient stronghold of Satanism.
Exactly.
In modern times. If you haven't read my Eisenhower research, and I would even suggest you read The Three Stooges Go to Washington.
I definitely will.
And my Teenage Mutant Ninja Eisenhowers and Teenage Mutant Ninja Birth Certificates, which will give you a very interesting perspective on this history you're talking about, because it ties into Austria-Hungary and the power structure behind the Austrian economic system. And I think it will lead to a lot of secret agreements that, were probably proffered at that time, because I see many of the current or the most recent candidates that we had for this presidency all being infiltrators into this country. None of them were born on American soil. And John McCain, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton being three of them. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty mind-blowing, but it keeps going back, even to Eisenhower. Eisenhower, I determined, was a bastard child of Franz Joseph I, the emperor for 68 years of Austria-Hungary.
Yes, sir.
And you find a lot of conclusions that have never been drawn as to the mass murder of many Nazi soldiers when Eisenhower took over command of you know, he became the supreme Allied commander.
Commander of Europe, yeah.
And was basically slaughtering these guys, torturing them, starving them, machine gunning them, and throwing them in gigantic pits. And of course, you have this Holocaust story being promoted, but you don't hear the other side of all the atrocities that were committed. And,
exactly.
And I literally put together how they financially pulled this off with documentation, letters. Eisenhower didn't have a birth certificate either.
Is that on your website?
That's on my website.
I'm definitely going to read it, my friend. Definitely going to read it. Because, you know, seen from Argentina, and let me just very quickly mention this, where we naturally, everybody here follows American politics much more than Americans would follow Argentinian politics. We all wonder, I mean, a country that has given a John Fitzgerald Kennedy, a William Jefferson Clinton, a George Herbert Walker Bush, all of a sudden your president is Barack Hussein Obama. Is this a joke? And he came out of nowhere. And, you know, people are wondering, what's his real name? Was it Soveteros? Was he born in the Philippines? Was he born in Kenya? Where the hell did this guy come from? So in a way, you figure somebody somewhere is really playing foul.
Well,
and I often wonder if Barack Obama isn't earmarked as one of the last presidents of the United States of America, that wonderful great experiment in world history called the United States of America. Because, you know, as we transition out of globalization, which is being wrapped up, and into legal world government, just as the Soviet Union was unacceptable when we went from the bipolar world into globalization 20 years ago, as we go from globalization to legal world government, it's America that is unacceptable. So in a way, they have to find, I often feel, a way of folding America. And what better way to have an unknown, funny-named, perhaps not born in America, black president to be one of the last presidents, or at least the one that could be held historically responsible for finally burying America in the grave of history.
Mm-hmm. And conveniently fomenting a multi-dimensional racial war as well.
Yeah. It's hideous what's being done.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I encourage you to read those articles.
Just, I will.
You know my website, directlightproductions.com. Just click on articles and have your way. It's several years of research in this, and I am debunking history as it's taught in the schools.
Very important, right?
Okay. Well, Adrian, we're out of time. I really want to thank you for staying up late. You're an hour ahead of Eastern time zone, so it's...
No, actually, we're 2 hours. It's 4:30 in the morning here.
Oh, my goodness. 2 hours? Oh.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, because you turn your clocks back, and we never go around changing our clocks.
Oh, so yes, you were an hour. So did you get any sleep last night?
Yeah, no, I slept before, and now I'll just have a quick nap, and then I'm off to work. But it's been my pleasure. I'm the one who must say thank you for having me on your show and giving me a lot of time to express my ideas and so forth. I see we have huge things in common and that we have a lot of work to do together. So whatever I can do to assist in your great and wonderful program, you need only ask.
Well, I'm honored to have you on, and you are doing great work, and I want to encourage all the listening audience to go to your website asalbucci.com. And any other information you want to give out before we say goodnight?
Basically, again, for everybody to stay alert, for everybody to stay safe, dramatic things are going to happen in the weeks and months to come in America, in Argentina, in Europe. So, you know, to be prepared is to be alert. And as you were saying, if people want to know more, and they can visit our site, www.asalbucci.com.ar, and also the www.secondrepublicprojectaltogether.com, where I think we pretty much, you know, we mentioned these five pillars you were graciously referring to. And, well, let's just keep working and keep fighting.
Yes, and I want to have you back on the show. I'm glad we worked out this hitch with the communications here.
Yeah, I've solved that. It was really a hardware problem with my router, which I've been able to sort out, so we're not going to have that problem anymore. And whenever you say, you just call the date, and I'll be more than happy to oblige.
Okay, all right. I'm booked up for the month, but things do change, so be ready for maybe a last-minute call here.
Great.
And I'll certainly have you on in December for sure. So
great, Don. It'll be my pleasure.
All right. My best to you and your fellow countrymen, and I'm looking forward to your next piece as well.
We'll do. I'll keep you posted. We'll stay in contact.
All right. Very good. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest all the way from Argentina, Mr. Adrian Salbucci. Special thanks go out to Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world for broadcasting this show either live or in an archive. If you haven't signed up for BBS Archives, please do so. It helps cover bandwidth costs and keeps this show alive. You get for a very nominal fee, you get a year subscription to all the archives at bbsradio.com. Tonight on The Sound, I want to thank both Don and Doug Newsom for tag teaming. Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow night when my special guest will be Dr. Mike Castle. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.